you know, normally what I do is kind of ramble for a bit to
set the mood.
Can you hear at the back? Is that right? Set the mood. But I'm a bit concerned about running over, so I think I'm going to more or less dive straight into the talk and try and stick to the script. That's a challenge. So I'm, you know, just briefly say, you know, thanks very much to Stefan Mariansky, Ivan Ward, who's the curator of the Festival of the Unconscious exhibition, and to my wife Zata Banks, who's through the auspices of her poetry film project, it's through her poetry film project that Ivan and Stefan became aware of some of the work that's now they're now exhibiting downstairs. And I said to him, "Oi, can I give a Rorschach audio talk as well?" And they said, "Oh, all right then." You know, so, and you know, thanks everybody for coming along. So, you know, there's nothing worse than having an empty room. If you're giving a talk, it's great. Thanks a lot. It's a scripted lecture, but there's a lot of high element of demonstration and kind of interactive stuff in it. So, you know, don't worry about. Hopefully, you know, it's not just me droning on for an hour, enjoying the sound of my own voice. There's actually quite a lot of fun stuff that will be demonstrated on. Audio and visual stuff that will be demonstrated as part of the talk. Okay, so Rorschach Audio, Art and Illusion for Sound is a book that was published in 2012. There is a perception, particularly among contemporary art critics and arts commentators, but also among members of the public, that sonic art is a relatively new art form. Of course, the truth is that sounds produced by voices are amongst the earliest raw materials ever to have been subjected to any form of creative manipulation. Speech itself is an art form. Maybe not in my case, but anyway. Speech itself is an art form, and therefore poetry and literature of the oral tradition are, alongside music, the oldest forms of sonic art, and probably the oldest art forms, full stop. On that basis, it can be argued that far from being a marginal or in any way sort of difficult art form, sonic art is instead the most primal, the most pervasive, and arguably the earliest form of creative art in any context. The argument put forward in my book Rorschach Audio is that, paraphrasing Aristotle's Poetics, since written language is based on symbolic visual representations of indivisible sounds, which is what Aristotle says, you know, letters represent sounds, the earliest form of sound recording technology was not, as it's generally presumed to have been, any form of machine, but was instead written language. Written language is a technology for recording sounds and reproducing sounds, or facilitating the reproduction of sounds. Alongside poetry and literature of the oral tradition, even written literature and poetry are therefore forms of sound art. So when one considers music, poetry, literature, theatrical dialogue, theatrical sound effects and architectural acoustics, and particularly also sound design for contemporary cinema and for computer games, etc., it can be argued that in its various diverse and widespread manifestations, sonic art is one of, if not the most mainstream and commercially important of cultural commodities. It's not really a sort of fringe interest, you know, it is arguably the most mainstream and commercially important of all cultural commodities. So, by way of partial illustration, the art of designing theatrical sound effects is, for instance, quite clearly a form of sound art, which goes back at least as far as those architects whose expertise ensured that the proverbial pin could be heard dropping throughout the auditoria of ancient Greek amphitheatres. Everybody knows that, I guess. As regards specifically British history, the theatre historian Robert Mott describes how since Shakespearean days, a popular method for creating illusions of thunder in theatre shows involved, quote, a cannonball rolling down a trough and falling onto a huge drum. Robert Mott states that, quote, some people were not pleased with this cumbersome technique. So as long ago as 1708, the dramatist John Dennis designed a thunder effect for his play Appius and Virginia at the Drury Lane Theatre in London. John Dennis, quote, invented something much more realistic and controllable. A large, thin piece of copper sheeting suspended on from a frame by wires. The Thunder Sheet was a great success, and as a result, other stage productions began using this effect, his effect. This infuriated Dennis to the point where he would angrily confront the offending producer by charging, you, sir, are stealing my thunder. Yeah? And Dennis is also said to have stated, that is my thunder, by God. The villains will play my thunder, but not my play. what this anecdote provides is not just another example, and there are thousands of others, of sort of early sound art, of sonic art that predates contemporary fine arts practice by 200 years in this case, but also potentially the earliest recorded instance of what amounts to an intellectual property dispute between sound artists. This dispute was in fact so important that the phrase "stealing my thunder" has, for hundreds of years, been immortalised as a very common figure of speech in the English language. So, you know, what I'm trying to do is kind of set the context for, you know, appreciation of some previously overlooked perspectives on sound in the arts and indeed in other areas too. The fact that, despite such history, is, you know, in my opinion, self-evident, kind of, you know, long history of sonic art is not generally perceived to be a mainstream art form, has arguably a great deal to do with phenomena of psychology of perception. And it's the psychology of perception of audible speech which forms the central focus of my Rorschach Audio project. Now, Rorschach Audio started out, there's a lot more to it than just this, but anyway, it started out as a critique of so-called electronic voice phenomena research. EVP is a belief system whose followers believe they're literally able to record the voices of ghosts. And as the demonstrations that you're about to hear on the DVD, that you're about to experience show, the misperception of stray radio and communications chatter as ghost voices stems from misrepresentations of psychoacoustic phenomena. That's not terribly surprising. EVP practitioners misperceive voices that they've recorded because those voices are sufficiently ambiguous and because the beliefs that EVP followers attach to their perceptions are sufficiently strong to produce sonic illusions which can be, if not objectively convincing, then strongly emotionally appealing. As well as demonstrating intriguing auditory phenomena, this talk is relevant to the sonic arts because so many often high-profile sonic artists work with EVP. It's almost like a sort of, you know, standard kind of subject matter of sort of contemporary sonic arts movement. You know, lots and lots and lots of sonic artists work with EVP. But also because the ideas linked to the individual generally recognised as the most important, historically important Western artist, and because they link to what is arguably the most important work of visual arts theory ever published. So hopefully that's two mysteries that I'll resolve later on in the talk. So to recap, electronic voice phenomena are a class of allegedly mysterious vocal recordings, and while several explanations have been offered to explain their origin, the majority of EVP researchers believe that their recordings constitute physical evidence of contact with the afterlife. In other words, these researchers mostly believe that it's possible, using various radio and electrical engineering techniques, to literally record the voices of ghosts. Now, that might sound a bit odd, but inventors Edison and Marconi both believed in the possibility that radio technology might enable contact with the afterlife, and their EVP researchers use Edison and Marconi as evidence of their sort of intellectual respectability all the time. And this idea sits well in context of Victorian enthusiasm for various forms of spiritualism. I mean, basically, EVP is a branch of spiritualism. But the EVP movement proper didn't begin until, like Victorian times, but in 1957, when Friedrich Jürgensen, an artist who painted portraits of Pope Pius XII, found voices intruding on recordings he'd made of his own voice and of birdsong. Convinced that these recordings represented communications from aliens and from his deceased mother, Jürgensen temporarily abandoned his artistic career to concentrate on these experiments and to publicise his findings, writing three books between 1960 and 1968. From 1968 onwards, Jürgensen cemented an increasingly close relationship with the Vatican, making a number of documentary films about religious themes and executing portrait commissions for Pope Paul VI. So, you know, he was a papal portrait painter and received a papal medal for his efforts in that respect. Jürgensen's books, and particularly the idea that he'd amassed evidence proving the existence of the afterlife, and, you know, as EVP supporters kind of construed it, providing scientific proof of the existence of the afterlife, quote-unquote, attracted media attention. A Latvian psychologist called Konstantin Radive, who claims to have been a student of Carl Jung, interestingly, took up the cause of EVP research, allegedly making tens of thousands of recordings. And it's through the publication of Radive's book, Breakthrough, in 1971, that Radive became the leading light in an international circle of EVP enthusiasts. Today, the movement that these two guys effectively founded has evolved into a widespread activity of such complexity that it would be difficult for anyone to attempt a comprehensive survey. I mean, EVP is a fringe belief system, but it's so sort of internationally pervasive that it has quite a lot of followers worldwide. The purpose of this talk is not to attempt a survey of that kind of nature, but to address the major salient issues which occur throughout EVP research, and which in fact underpin the entire belief system. We'll get on to the fun stuff in a second. My own first exposure to EVP was probably, you know, a lot of people in my generation, similarly, hearing a flexi disc of voices recorded by Konstantin Radivay, which was published around 1982 by the Unexplained magazine, which was, you know, a sort of part work magazine that was published to do stuff about UFOs and Bigfoot and things like that. You know, one of the kids at school bought him a copy of this magazine. The style of these recordings is typical of EVP. You'll hear in a second. A narrator introduces ghostly contacts, which manifest as brief bursts of distorted voice, accompanied by very high levels of radio interference and machine noise picked up from the recording apparatus by a microphone. The examples are repeated several times, and the ambience of the recordings is menacing. My initial reaction to hearing this material was, frankly, one of disbelief, because, you know, in addition to instinctive scepticism about any claim to the existence of the afterlife or the supernatural, you know, in fact, as anybody who's kind of experimented with tape recording techniques, you know, even in the 70s, would be aware, outright forgery of these kind of recordings would be absolute child's play, to put it bluntly. The most primitive tape recording and overdubbing techniques could easily produce recordings of this nature, not least because, and this is with sort of nudging into one of the interesting psychological aspects of this, the more basic the technology used, the rougher the recordings, the more the finished product would resonate with an aura of menacing low fidelity mystique, which can paradoxically even help lend a subjective impression of authenticity to such material. You know, the paradox is that if the voices recorded were of similar quality to conventional studio recordings of speech, then nobody would have believed in the ghost voices for a minute. You know, the sort of weird thing that if you came up to some people and said, well, look, you know, I know your relative is deceased, I have a perfect studio quality recording of their voice made in conversation with them after they died, most people would feel, I think, quite deeply insulted, you know. But paradoxically, because the recordings are of such poor quality, people attempted a little bit, just a little bit, to sort of suspend disbelief a little bit more than they would have done if the recordings are of very, very pristine quality, which is kind of an interesting aspect of it. Anyway, however, having said all that, I'll also describe why I now believe that some EVP researchers have perfectly genuine motives, and that many of the signals they've recorded are not consciously faked, but are instead commonplace and physically real material phenomena whose origin and nature they have completely misunderstood. So, you know, let's have a few examples of the classic EVP recordings from that accompanied Radivay's book Breakthrough.
The text spoken by the voices and the sound volume are exactly the same as in the original recording. To help the air adapt itself to the strange rhythm, rapidity and softness of the voice entity's speech, each utterance is repeated several times.
Can you all hear at the back, okay?
The voices here selected are grouped according to the persons addressed and their respective answers, followed by a translation and explanation. They are examples chosen to give the reader a breakthrough, an acoustic illustration of the material presented in the book. The listener is asked to read any text spoken in languages he does not know, with particular attention, so that he may be able to grasp each separate word phonetically. Please note the commentary that goes with each voice text, as the meaning of some utterances can only be understood in context with the situation that gave rise to them.
The first voice is that of Margareta Petralski, who had told the experimenter during her lifetime that she did not believe in an existence after death. After her passing, the experimenter asked her how she felt in the beyond. and a voice, identified as coming from Margarete, answered, Bedenke, ich bin. German, imagine, I am. Again we hear Margarete Petrowski's voice, this time calling her former employer, Dr. Zenta Maurina. Zenta. Now the experimenter asks if Margarete can hear him, and the voice replies, Kostya, ja. German, Kostya, yes. The voice then calls the experimenter's family name, Raudive, but shortens it to Raudiv. And now we hear in Latvian and German, Koste, tu tik na. You are so near. Now the experimenter calls the Russian poet Vladimir Mayakovsky, and the voice answers, Mayakovsky. The experimenter tells the poet how difficult it is to convince people of the reality of the voice phenomenon. And in reply comes a statement which is typical for Mayakovsky's personality. Konstantin, pluj. In Russian, Konstantin, spit on it.
There you go. So, I mean, you know, that goes on to
the experimenter talks to his
quite some time. One of the weird things about that recording is it was, I guess, originally recorded on open reel tape, and you can actually hear a sort of kickback from the underlying layers of the other bits of the tape on that thing. So there are, in fact, ghost voices on that recording of ghost voices. You know, I've never actually kind of like fiddled about with audio software to try and recover them or find out what they're saying. But, you know, sometimes the PA system in a lecture theatre will oblige by picking up some stray radio signals and whispering a bit to people, but it seems to be behaving today, unfortunately. You know, it's normally the case when you have, like, speaker cables wrapped around a room, you know, rather than a self-contained system like this. Anyway, so there's tons of that kind of stuff. Loads of movies have been made about it. Loads of books have been written about it. It's a sort of occasionally, from, you know, comes around in roughly 10-year cycles, a kind of theme that gets picked up by the popular press and does, you know, tend to get represented at least to some audiences as being a form of scientific research. You know, it's not enormously widespread, but, you know, it's a sort of persistent aspect of popular culture, I guess you could say. Now, the idea that, you know, despite the strength of this evidence, EVP could be described as authentic phenomena, and that explanations do exist to account for how they arise, comes from several sources. This is really great stuff. The neurologist Oliver Sacks discusses acoustic projection in his book Seeing Voices, quoting descriptions of the, quote, eye music and phantasmal voices experienced by the poet David Wright in his autobiographical book Deafness. So, having lost his sense of hearing in childhood, after the onset of spoken language, David Wright found himself able to experience reconstructed sound images projected by his mind into his perceived environment as an extension of visual information. So, lip reading triggered actual voices inside David Wright's head, despite the fact that no environmental sound was being provided by his ears. The projecting effect was so strong that David Wright even reported hearing ghost sounds conjured by the motion of trees in wind. David Wright explained that, quote, "My deafness was made more difficult to perceive because from the very first my eyes had unconsciously begun to translate motion into sound. My mother spent most of the day beside me and I understood everything she said. Without knowing it, I had been reading her mouth all my life. When she spoke, I seemed to hear her voice. It was an illusion which persisted even after I knew it was an illusion. My father, my cousin, and everyone I'd known retained phantasmal voices. That these voices were imaginary, the projections of habit and memory, did not come home to me until after I'd left the hospital. One day I was talking with my cousin and he, in a moment of inspiration, covered his mouth with his hand as he spoke. Silence." David Wright's faculties may sound extraordinary, but what I hope to demonstrate through the video clips you'll see is that his experiences are extreme manifestations, or highly, more sort of unusually developed manifestations of a capacity for projection that not only manifests in all senses, in all people, able-bodied or otherwise, but which in fact underpins the whole process of perception. So, for instance, the psychoacoustics demonstration known as the McGurk effect, designed by Harry McGurk and John McDonald from the University of Surrey, refers to an experiment in which volunteers were asked to describe what they heard after watching videos of a face reading monosyllables. Now, apologies, you know, this is quite a well-known illusion. It's been shown on TV a couple of times. It's got lots of hits on YouTube and all this kind of stuff. So if you've seen it before, you know, bear with me. But anyway, it's still great stuff. So, you know, volunteers were asked to describe what they heard after watching videos of a face reading monosyllables. The sounds they heard were modified by the visual information provided by the face. When the video was dubbed so that the face says gar, but the voice is replaced by the sound bar, listeners described hearing the syllable da, which is acoustically midway between gar and bar. Now, that sounds a bit confusing. What you've got in this video is the bloke standing in front of the video going, let me get this right, gar gar, gar gar, gar gar. and that's the sound. He was filmed saying gaga, gaga, gaga. The soundtrack has in fact been erased and replaced with another recording of him saying ba ba, ba ba, ba ba. So that's the actual sound that you hear coming out of the loudspeakers. But when you see the face on screen, the actual sound that you hear is, I mean, obviously this is a subjective phenomenon, so, you know, responses are going to vary from individual to individual to some extent, but fairly reliably people tend to report that the sound that they hear is more like da 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 da. So it's neither of the sound that's been erased or the sound with which it's been replaced, and the sort of conflict between the visual information that you're receiving through lip reading and face reading is resolved by the brain turning the sound that you perceive as being a real object in the external world into a slightly different perception. It does look a bit silly, this, without wishing to be rude to its authors, it does look a bit silly, this video, but, you know, in my opinion, the bit where it's most interesting is when you're watching the video and you realise that the sound that you hear in your ears, that you rely upon your sense of hearing to provide you with accurate representations of the external world, but the sound that you hear with your ears changes slightly depending on whether or not your eyes are open or closed, you know, and that's the point at which this demonstration becomes most interesting.
Former teacher.
Ba ba, 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 ba ba. Ba ba, ba ba, ba ba, ba ba, ba ba, ba ba.
Okay, so, and how do people get on with that? Yeah. You know, this effect has been reproduced dozens and dozens of times with all kinds of different experiments. So, you know, it's sort of reasonably reliable. But some of the other clips that I'll show you in a second are even more. You know, the illusions they produce are even more.
Isn't it strange to people that when I saw him,
yeah,
it was coming across dark, dark. When I closed my eyes,
yeah,
it went back to bar bar.
Yeah. Okay, so Among wartime experiences described in his autobiographical novel The Periodic Table, Primo Levi, you know, fantastic author, former resistance, anti-fascist resistance fighter in the Italian resistance, and chemical engineer. Primo Levi described a laboratory apparatus called a heterodyne, which he used in the factory where he used to work during the war, which under certain conditions could be rigged up to function as a radio. Basically, a heterodyne is a device for tuning signals, so you attach an antenna and a nerve cable to it, you can get it to behave like a radio. Primo Levi described, quote, an intricate universe of mysterious messages, Morse tickings, modulated hisses, deformed, mangled voices which pronounce sentences in incomprehensible languages or in code, messages of death, a radiophonic babble of war. And it's perhaps not surprising that studies of this whole kind of confusing wartime sound world provide some useful clues to help understand the enigma of EVP. So, case in point, Olive Rainier and Vladimir Rubinstein's book Assigned to Listen, for instance, also states, like with David Wright, that, quote, the mechanism of projection plays a major part in hearing. The Assigned to Listen book describes the ether war, as they called it, fought by BBC foreign language radio monitors who scanned the Second World War's remorseless sea of noises, as they put it, for the broken voices, coded messages, news, propaganda, disinformation and entertainment broadcasts that fought for bandwidth with the incessant vagaries of ionospheric propagation and the turbulence of electrical and magnetic storms. The wartime BBC radio monitors recorded, you know, basically what they were doing was recording open broadcast access radio, so German and Italian radio and stuff like that, and then transcribing it to producing bulletins based on the transcripts, which are then sort of sent to Winston Churchill and the War Office and, you know, all the relevant Foreign Office, different departments of the government. The wartime radio monitors recorded often already very weak sounds onto primitive Ediphone wax cylinder transcribers, which were sold as dictation machines before the Second World War, because open reel tape recorders hadn't come into being yet, thereby degrading the quality of discernible intelligence to the point where the problems encountered converged with issues familiar to military photo reconnaissance analysts and to restorers of antique paintings, you know, which is, to what extent is my imagination kind of influencing the meaning that I'm attributing to this, you know, sort of potentially ambiguous subject matter. The need to reanalyse, you know, the BBC monitors found that their need to reanalyse voice recordings over and over and over again to detect faint traces of intelligence in the dense fog of noise is in fact virtually identical to some EVP research techniques, but, you know, not surprisingly, this book doesn't make any mention of a BBC monitor ascribing a signal to a ghost anyway. Assigned to Listen states that, quote, projection is the mechanism by which we read familiar shapes into clouds or melodies into the monotonous rattle of a train. In a similar way, we can read speech into a medley of noises. Leonardo da Vinci advised young painters to practice their imagination by looking at cracked walls and reading fantastic scenes into strange patches. An important lesson of the BBC monitor's wartime experience was that they should not be too dogmatic about saving, so to speak, a difficult interpretation. You know, you sit there listening to some really important stuff, it's potentially life or death material, the kind of intelligence that's attached to a particular radio message. You have to make sense of it, there's a lot of pressure. You think you've got a couple of words, and the rest of it just doesn't fall into place. So, you know, there's this temptation to so-called save an interpretation, rescue the, you know, you've got a few meaningful words, and it's, you know, you're desperate to attach meaning to the rest of the sentence that you've recorded. In such situations, they should instead recognise the importance of admitting failure when necessary and of discarding incorrect hypotheses, even if much effort had been invested in their formation. If a monitor thought that he or she had finally made sense of a distorted voice, only to find its apparent meaning contradicted by the sounds that followed, they should not try and force the square peg into the round hole out of sheer frustration. They should instead relax, staying true to the axiom that tiny bursts of information are inherently easier to misinterpret than large ones, and trust that their inability to interpret the larger sense showed that their initial guess had in fact always been wrong. The whole comes before the part. So they should instead formulate a new hypothesis and test that until it too was either discarded or proven. This is essentially, you know, a sort of microcosm of Karl Popper's version of scientific research methodology. scientific philosopher Karl Popper, you know, the idea of sort of hypothesis testing and hypothesis destruction. A 1996 Scientific American article by Sean Carlson described a really fantastic experiment by Diana Deutsch, who's a professor at the University of California, San Diego. And this recording that you're about to hear is a wonderful example of, in my opinion, scientists beating artists absolutely hands down at their own game in producing sort of, you know, scientific research material that excels as an artwork, much better than its sort of counterparts in the sonic art scene. Diana Deutsch produced this recording which demonstrates how acoustic projections can be explored in controlled conditions, and we'll try it out in a second. Diana Deutsch recorded a person speaking two neutral words and created a sequence in which the voice samples are reproduced in alternating stereo channels. It is in fact a recording of herself saying the words high and low, high and low. And unfortunately, on the CD that where this recording was originally made available, which is now sold out, it starts off where she doesn't just say high and low, she starts off the CD, she says, this CD takes you into the strange and paradoxical world of illusion. So it's kind of like, she starts off the CD like you're sitting down at a seance, you know, around the table with the sort of black curtains all around you. So it would be kind of nice to have incorporated that into the Rorschach audio talk, but I couldn't really find a place to put it. But you know, it's a bit like the, you know, she speaks a bit like this kind of strident, sort of slightly, sort of unnerving voice, a bit like the narrator in the Radiovay's Breakthrough recordings, you know. So anyway, it's a shame we haven't got that, but when the recording of her own voice is played back fast enough that the sounds remain recognisable as being voices, but their semantic content is completely scrambled, the sequence produces what the Scientific American describes as a pattern that sounds like language, but the words are not quite recognisable. Sean Carlson continues, within a few seconds of listening to this strange cacophony, my brain started imposing a shifting order over the chaos as I began hearing distinct words and phrases. First came blank, blank, blank. Then time, time, time. Then no time, long pine, and any time. Last time I gave this talk was in Melbourne, so it's got a good laugh, this bit in Melbourne. I'm quoting directly from the Scientific American here. I was then astonished to hear a man's voice spinning out of the right-hand speaker only. In a distinct Australian accent, it said, take me, take me, take me. So, you know, reading this article and then buying the CD, you know, obviously the first thing that springs to mind is Herman Rorschach's ink blot tests, you know, where you get a piece of paper, fold it in half, splash ink on it, fold it in half, then unfold it and get these symmetrical patterns, which were, I mean, these aren't the original Rorschach ink blot cards, but you know, stylistically, this is the ink blot set designed by the Redstone Press. You know, this kind of thing, you know, that sort of, you know, people perceive, you know, images of monsters or demons or whatever, sort of staring at them, glaring at them out of the cards. You know, this is used as a sort of diagnostic technique in some forms of Freudian psychoanalysis. Here's the man himself, you know, no doubt. Will be featuring in a film of his life, starring Brad Pitt, you know. That's exactly what he looks like, you know. Died in 1921 at the age of 21, or possibly 22, I think. So, I mean, by way of the ink blot test, you know, on the basis of take me, take me, take me, take me, you know, the obvious sort of psychological resonances of that interpretation, you know, lead me to instantly form the title Rorschach Audio, basically. And it's interesting to see that, however, that three sample inkblot interpretations, which is described in a standard university textbook called Psychology by psychologist Henry Gleitman, you know, in Henry Gleitman's, you know, brick-sized standard university textbook, there, you know, there's a little section on the Rorschach test, and there are a couple of inkblots in there, and the sample interpretations that he describes in the book are a head blowing smoke, but also a ghost and an angel, the last two being projections that very strongly resemble the emotional agenda of EVP. Okay, so let's try out Diana Deutsch and see how you'll react to this. Yeah. The first is that you feel like the recording's kind of drifting around a bit and sort of wandering around the place and stuff like that, as your mind tries to attach, you know, a certain amount, as your mind tries to attach meaning to the ambiguous material, you find that the recording sort of seems to drift around in sort of three-dimensional space and also sort of in relation to your head and stuff like that. Pretty much everybody, even from a brief exposure, will have that experience almost immediately. The second experience that, again, pretty much everybody will have, but it might take a few moments for the effect to build up, is that, you know, the sounds start to resemble meaningful words. The third level of experience that you're less likely to have and is most likely to only sort of occur after a very long period of exposure is that you actually feel like somebody's whispering a word right in your ear. I mean, it really can be quite unnerving when that happens, but you might have to listen to that for maybe 10 or 15 minutes before, you know, you get a really, really strong impression like that. But the interesting thing is that all three of those experiences are auditory illusions, not just the second and third one, you know. So even the drifting itself, this material is completely, absolutely, rigidly monotonous, you know. So even just the sense of drifting is in itself an auditory illusion. So, in contrast to the flexible and diverse projections produced of the sort that you've no doubt just sort of experienced from listening to Diana Deutsch's recording, the preemptive narration that's typical of EVP demonstration recordings tells listeners in advance how to interpret those recordings, creating a false sense that the meaning comes from outside the individual listener's imagination, because everybody in the room has been told that it says Tuesday, so everybody hears Tuesday, if you see what I mean. And therefore, you know, this process of prompting creates the illusion that, well, you know, I heard it and I thought it said that, and he heard it and he thought he said that. We're all agreeing on this, so, you know, we're all honestly reporting the evidence of our own senses, which is a sort of concept that most people equate with sort of proper science, so to speak. Therefore, our perceptions are objective, you know, because we're honestly reporting the evidence of our own senses. So, using the prompting technique, one of the things that EVP researchers do, sometimes willfully and sometimes perhaps simply by accident, is to create to sort of build upon the auditory illusion by creating a further illusion, in this case an illusion of objectivity. You know, they're creating the illusion that what they're doing is scientific research. As the assigned to listen book says, quote, projections have a way of sticking to a sound. Now, in terms of where these kind of EVP stuff actually comes from, signals from across the entire radio spectrum share a tendency to drift away from their original broadcast frequencies and to demodulate onto amplifying circuits, as all amplifiers within radios can function as broadband so-called very low frequency receivers. VLF band is a sort of part of the radio spectrum that's not used very much for sort of communications purposes because it's so full of, you know, kind of interference and sort of electrical junk, if you see what I mean. So microphone cables are the sort typically used by early EVP researchers when they were, like when Radivé was, Jürgensen was recording Birdsong and so forth, often function as very low frequency antennas. So the microphone cable can function as a radio antenna, especially when it's unshielded, i.e. the old fashioned type, and used out of doors. Taxis, police and ambulance, air traffic control, maritime, military, short, medium and long wave commercial broadcasts, TV voice channels, radio ham experiments, CB radio, bugging devices, conferencing systems, intercoms, baby alarms and analog mobile phones all share this tendency to emerge in that same very low frequency wave band, frequently producing these stray signals. Stray voices are well known to concert PA operators, people who install in-car entertainment systems, and to wildlife recording engineers who employ a whole arsenal of electromagnetic shielding devices to eliminate this exact form of interference. But when stray signals are heard, they're often very distorted and garbled, owing to kind of intermodulation effects, and therefore ideal raw material for acoustic projection. Some EVP researchers have attempted to exclude these kinds of interference using metal Faraday cages, you know, sort of building a bird cage around the radio bill or the tape recorder, which surround the experimental apparatus, picking up and draining the external electromagnetic or radio field into the earth. However, most EVP techniques require not the removal, but the addition of extra noise to the basic input in order to improve the success of the EVP recordings. This is a psychologically interesting point. So, radio static, deliberately mistuned voice transmissions, especially in languages not understood by the researcher, audio oscillators, microphone feedback and tape recordings of foreign language courses, birdsong, fountains, hissing taps, rain, surf and wind have all been used. Deliberately adding noise to improve EVP reception may sound counterintuitive, but there are several experiments which demonstrate the importance of adding noise. I've had to chop a bit out here for length, but anyway, for instance, the psychologist Albert Bregman from McGill University in Canada prepared with Pierre Ahad a demonstration which shows how adding noise, in this case to interrupted speech recordings, can help the mind to try and fill in missing information. This is probably the most robust of the demonstrations that I'm going to play this evening. In the following recording, alternating 1/6 and then 1/4 second long sections in a speech recording are replaced by silences. So you have a sentence that sounds a bit like sort of thing, and it's what's that comedian called? There was a comedian from up north who did the broken microphone routine. It was basically the same thing. So it's basically the broken microphone routine. However, and you know, the 1/6 and 1/4 long section, quarter second long sections in the speech recording are replaced by silences, with the effect that the sentence is made unintelligible. When the silences are replaced by white noise, however, white noise sounding almost exactly like radio static, most listeners report hearing a continuous stream of speech, with that continuous speech appearing to continue underneath and through the noise bursts, and in fact to run throughout the recording. Thing is, even if you can't, with the noise bursts added to the superimposed over the interruptions in the recording, it's still very hard to make out what the voice is actually saying, but you do hear a continuous stream of speech. That continuous stream is, however, an audio illusion. The effect is sometimes known as phonemic restoration. And it's actually, in the old days of sort of analog sound recording, it was used quite a lot in cinema sound design to sort of recover bits of missing speech from dialogue recordings for films. So, for instance, you employ an actor that costs a lot of money, you record their voice for a sequence in a film, the magnetic tape, as magnetic tape often did, you know, the oxide would flake off the magnetic tape and there'd be a little pause in the speech, which was, you know, it's too expensive to get the guy back to re-record it, right? So what you do is you put the sound of a backfiring car or a hand clap or somebody sneezing or something like that over the bit, and then people just perceive continuous speech running throughout the whole thing. Okay, so we'll play this clip.
The picket fence effect with speech. We play a sentence in which half of the sound has been eliminated by taking out every other 1/6 second segment and replacing it with a silence. Then the same sentence is played with loud noise bursts, replacing the silences. Does this make the speech sound more complete? Finally, you will hear the intact sentence.
Utter in and out is an odd group of sound. The principle of similarity is very important. Utter in and out is an odd group of sound. The principle of similarity is very important. Utter in and out is an odd group of sound. The principle of similarity is very important. Again, half the speech is deleted, but this time every other quarter second segment has been deleted. Again, judge the apparent completeness of the sentence.
Auditory signals involve grouping sound. The principle of similarity is important. Auditory signals involve grouping sound. The principle of similarity is important.
Okay, so I mean, you know, that shows how adding noise paradoxically can help to improve the perception of damaged or interrupted speech recordings. As for prompting, the role of prompting, this is, you know, vividly illustrated by another psychoacoustics demonstration prepared by Philip Rubin. He invented a technique known as sine wave speech involves creating computer synthesized simulations of the major energy bands or formants in real speech recordings. So you record some real speech. You take a spectral analysis, it doesn't really matter what that is if you're not familiar with that, of the recorders. You'll sort of make a spectrum of the speech recording and then use a synthesizer to kind of copy the major sort of harmonic bands within the speech recording. So you get a sort of resynthesis of human speech that basically sounds a bit like the clangers, the sound effects for the clangers. And that's a non-trivial comparison for anybody who wants to look into the background of that. The clangers effectively invented sine wave speech, and the BBC ran psychology experiments on those sound effects before sine wave speech was officially invented, so to speak. Okay, so as you'll hear on first hearing, you'll hear in a second, the meaning of sine wave speech is usually fairly hard to discern. After, however, you've heard the natural voice recording from which that sine wave speech was originally made, and then hear the sine wave speech again, more accurate perceptions suddenly jump out from what were previously quite unintelligible sound recordings. This effect shows how EVP demonstrations use prompting, prior knowledge, to convince listeners that the interpretation projected by the original EVP researcher is shared, thereby creating the illusion that EVP recordings are objective evidence.
Her skirt.
See, works quite well, doesn't it? Tends to work much better with short sequences because, you know, as a scientist says, you know, short pieces of information are much easier to misinterpret than longer ones because, you know, they don't have the kind of coherence of a predictable linguistic pattern to kind of allow the pieces to fall into place. Anyway.
The police returned to the museum.
Oh yeah. Okay. A typical EVP process involves prompting the imagination by asking in this way, you know, asking questions of the alleged ghosts out loud, a bunch of people sitting around a table with a tape recorder. asking questions of the alleged ghosts out loud in the style of a spiritualist seance, recording the stuff that comes back in through the, onto the tape recorder or through a radio, then repeatedly analysing any signals that emerge. Often they emerge after a very, very long wait, which is some EVP researchers rarely mentioned. You know, you might have to wait 45 minutes for a tiny burst of speech to emerge on the system. Researchers allege the presence of polyglot voices, i.e. voices which switch language from one word to the next. I mean, it's often been said that, isn't it paradoxical that Radivé claimed to have repeatedly recorded the voice of Hitler speaking in Latvian, but I don't think Hitler actually spoke Latvian. So they allege the presence of polyglot voices which switch languages from one word to the next within the same phrase. And enthusiasts evidently scour foreign dictionaries for meanings that match the rhythms of recorded sequences. EVP researchers maintain that ghosts invent neologisms and take liberties with grammar. So we're asked to accept that entities which have acquired the intellect to speak many languages they didn't speak before have lost the ability to speak grammatically or to use proper words. You know, these interpretive techniques set the widest possible parameters for the subjective attribution of meaning. And as before, by asking questions of the spirit world out loud, researchers tell themselves and other listeners how to interpret the sounds before the signals manifest, heavily influencing subsequent analysis. I'll skip a bit here. In his treatise on physiological optics of 1866, the great German psychologist Hermann Helmholtz describes human perceptions as unconscious inductive inferences which, despite heavy reliance on memory as well as upon direct sensation, quote, come about with immutable certainty. That's the interesting thing, certainty, at lightning speed and without the slightest meditation. In other words, Helmholtz was saying that, consciousness comes about as a result of sort of unconscious processes, which despite the fact that they very strongly influence, well, I'm not going to put it very well, what we perceive as consciousness, we don't really have to kind of think consciously for these perceptions to kind of form, despite their imaginary aspects, at a speed that's necessary for us to be able to sort of superimpose them upon reality. Didn't actually put that very well, but it may make sense to some people. Helmholtz's theory of what he called perceptual hypotheses suggests, in plain language, that much of what we experience as normal reality is in fact intelligent guesswork. Perceptual hypotheses, intelligent guesswork, is more or less the same thing. So, with hearing as well as with vision, and particularly when speech is distorted, obscured, or interrupted by noise, the mind makes use of creative and extremely well-informed guesswork. That's another point to stress. Just because we use a lot of guesswork in forming our perceptions doesn't mean to say that that guesswork isn't accurate, because we've spent our entire lives developing these very, very sophisticated strategies for representing the external world. It can be demonstrated through psychology experiments that there's a lot of guesswork involved in how we perceive reality, but those guesses are overwhelmingly, to most everyday practical intents and purposes, accurate, which is an interesting paradox. The paradox is that it is in part that guesswork which we experience as being reality. Normally this guesswork generates perceptions which agree with a whole spectrum of inputs from taste, vision, touch, smell, and memory. Normally that guesswork creates images which provide accurate representations of reality. So we're only consciously aware of the process of projection itself, and especially its imaginary and subjective aspect, when it very occasionally generates perceptions which disagree with that broad context. It's those rare mistakes only that we consciously categorise as being illusions. So what I'm arguing is that, you know, there are perceptual processes that enable us to construct representations of reality. Very occasionally those mechanisms are faced with stimuli that are so ambiguous that we don't know what kind of meaning to attach to them, and it's those stimuli that we produce, that we perceive or categorise as being illusions, that we call illusions. We're familiar with optical illusions from looking at the work of M.C. Escher, or looking at ambiguous figures in psychology textbooks, etc., etc. The point to emphasise here is that the processes that are producing those illusions are exactly the same processes that generate much of what we perceive as being everyday reality. Psychological projection is discussed in some detail in the art theorist and historian Ernst Gombrich's classic book Art and Illusion. Gombrich site. He was a local resident of Hampstead. Gombrich cites the artist Leonardo da Vinci's advice to painters, which is particularly interesting because of its final sentence, which doesn't get quoted very often. Leonardo da Vinci's notebooks say, "You should look at certain walls stained with damp, or at stones of uneven colour. If you have to invent some backgrounds for a painting, you'll be able to see in these the likenesses of divine landscapes adorned with mountains, ruins, rocks, woods, plains, hills and valleys in great variety. And then again, you'll be able to see their battles and strange figures in violent action, expressions of faces and clothes and an infinity of things which you will be able to reduce to their complete and proper forms. In such walls, the same thing happens as in the sound of bells, church bells, in whose stroke you may find every named word you can imagine." You know, so what Leonardo da Vinci, you know, arguably the most important or the most famous Western artist in the Western tradition, was describing was basically exactly the same as the Diana Deutsch experiment. It has been suggested that this faculty was associated with Leonardo's very highly developed sort of creative and cognitive abilities. But in fact, you know, oranges and lemons, say the bells of St. Clement's. When will you pay me, say the bells at Old Bailey. Everybody has a sort of, you know, intrinsically has a capacity to form exactly these kinds of auditory illusions. So the illusion that Leonardo da Vinci described is related to that which you've experienced during this presentation, and it was in fact Ernst Gombrich, author of Art and Illusion, who, during World War II, was the monitoring supervisor in the BBC monitoring service, who wrote all of the material about acoustic projection quoted from the book Assigned to Listen. So Gombrich was a major contributor to this publication. The material in Assigned to Listen, the authors of that book themselves quoted from an internal BBC memorandum produced, written by Gombrich, called Some Axioms, Musings and Hints on Hearing. And in highlighting this connection between the theories that Gombrich articulated in his post-war masterpiece Art and Illusion and his work during the Second World War, you know, his sort of theories about psychology of perception, the Rorschach Audio Project emphasises the role that relatively little-known wartime intelligence work with sound had on what is arguably the most important work of visual arts theory ever published. And what's most surprising is that while the influence of Leonardo da Vinci's advice on figurative and abstract painting is probably inestimable, I mean, everybody knows that quote about the stained walls, from the point of view of contemporary fine arts practice, Leonardo da Vinci's final sentence about sound seems to have been largely ignored. What I'm going to do now, sort of wind towards the end of the talk, is play you a video called The Analysis of Beauty, which is being exhibited downstairs. So it's a shameless plug for my art project Disinformation, and one of the exhibits that Disinformation produces is The Analysis of Beauty, which was, the title is taken from a book published in 1753 by William Hogarth, which is all about the beauty of waving serpentine lines, as he called them, snake-like lines, but in modern nomenclature we would refer to as the sine wave. Now, the Hogarth aspect of this demonstration is a bit complicated. And not really worth going into in this context. However, what you will see in a second, I'll just play it anyway because it's really a negligible soundtrack. I can explain it while it's running. So these are the serpentine lines, okay? Now, what I'm hoping to demonstrate here is the formation, you know, you experience the formation and self-contradiction of sort of competing perceptual hypotheses listening to the Diana Deutsch recording. This demonstration provides a very close visual analogue or illustration of the formation of perceptual hypotheses. Now, look at the pattern for a minute and try and decide what direction it's rotating in. Okay? And then see whether or not it continues rotating in the same direction. You might want to try tilting your head from side to side, or blinking, or just kind of locking on visually to a different part of the pattern. And you may find that, you know, the image appears to be rotating to the left, and then suddenly it appears to be rotating to the right, and so forth. You know, it can take a little while sometimes for these sort of forms to build up, all those impressions to build up in your mind. Bearing in mind that you have a completely flat image here. After looking at it for a little while, hopefully it will start to form into a solid object. You know, reasonably convincing facsimile of a solid object. What you have here is an image that has absolutely, you know, creates a reasonably vivid impression of three-dimensional form, of actual sort of visual depth of space, despite the fact that this image contains absolutely none of the object precedence, motion parallax, geometric and aerial perspective, or stereoscopic and monocular cues that are conventionally thought to enable perceptions of visual space, i.e. you perceive visual space because one object obscures, a closer object obscures a further object. You perceive visual space because of the way you, because of your working knowledge of how objects move relative to each other when you're looking at them in sort of the real world, motion parallax. You have geometric or vanishing point perspective that's, you know, used by artists. Aerial perspective, as moisture builds up in the air, objects in the distance become fainter as the mist kind of accumulates in your field of view. And, you know, what's typically associated with most 3D entertainment systems is binocular stereoscopic visual information that through having, you know, being able to compare the images from two, the disparity between the images from two eyes, you can also make a, you know, create very, very strong impressions of visual depth. Now, this video has absolutely none of any of those, but you're still able to form quite strong impressions of visual form. The changes that you're seeing when the form flips from one side to another are not taking place on screen, they're taking place inside your own mind. Okay, so I think that provides a pretty good sort of analogue of, you know, an illustration of the concept of perceptual hypotheses, particularly the way perceptual hypotheses can, without corroborative evidence, can actually contradict each other. You know, so it's consistent with the view that EVP as a religious belief system, rather than as a body of evidence, EVP as a belief system, stems from the misunderstanding of audio illusions that Sigmund Freud bluntly stated in his book, The Future of an Illusion. Standard edition of the Complete Psychological Works of Sigmund Freud, volume 21, 1927 to 1931. Sigmund Freud stated in his book, The Future of an Illusion, that, quote, the psychical origin of religious ideas does not stem from experience or from the end results of thinking. He's being a bit harsh, but that it stems instead from, quote, illusions, fulfillments of the oldest, strongest, and most urgent wishes of mankind. If you're not familiar with it already, The Future of an Illusion is entirely a critique of religious belief systems. Interestingly, however, you know, the tone of Freud's analysis of religion is quite hostile, quite unsparingly critical. However, Freud also stated that with religious beliefs, quote, devout believers are safeguarded against the risk of certain neurotic illnesses because their acceptance of the universal neurosis, the overall religious belief system, spares them the task of constructing a personal one. And this, you know, seems to be consistent with recent evidence that suggests that people who have strong belief systems, you know, not necessarily religious belief systems, but overwhelmingly religious belief systems, actually live longer than people who don't. It's a widely publicised research findings that were discussed a lot in the media about a year ago. So Freud also stated that with religious beliefs, devout believers are safeguarded against the risk of certain neurotic illnesses because their acceptance of the universal neurosis spares them the task of constructing a personal one. So, you know, religious beliefs in that sense have a very powerful social function to perform, you know, but arguably even a kind of evolutionary value perhaps, you know, wandering off too far. As to the question of integrity, however, factual integrity, Freud asserted that, quote, where questions of religion are concerned, people are guilty of every possible sort of dishonesty and intellectual misdemeanour. And this arguably harsh judgment was not intended to be taken just as a generalisation, for Freud goes on to specifically comment on spiritualism, stating that, quote, if all the evidence put forward for the authenticity of religious teachings originates in the past, it is natural to look round and see whether the present may not also be able to furnish evidence. The proceedings of the spiritualists meet us at this point. They're convinced of the survival of the individual soul, and they seek to demonstrate to us, beyond doubt, that the truth of this one religious doctrine. Unfortunately, they cannot succeed in refuting the fact that the appearance and utterances of their spirits are merely the products of their own mental activity. They have called up the spirits of the greatest men and of the most eminent thinkers, but all the pronouncements and information which they've received from them seem to have been so foolish and so wretchedly meaningless that one can find nothing in them but the capacity of the spirits to adapt themselves to the circle of people who've conjured them up. As to the ethical dilemma of disillusioning people of belief in life after death, Freud asserts that, quote, those who do not suffer from the neurosis will need no intoxicant to deaden it. And although these people will therefore, quote, have to admit to the full extent of their insignificance in the machinery of the universe, as Freud put it, in regard to what Freud called education to reality, he believed that, quote, men cannot remain children forever. In relation to the formation of what we referred to earlier as perceptual hypotheses, volume 23 of Freud's standard edition, thanks to Ivan for this quote, states that, quote, the process of something becoming conscious is above all linked with the perceptions which our sense organs receive from the external world. From the topographical point of view, and I think what he meant by topographical was sort of, the actual sort of physical mapping of the sort of, surfaces in the brain and so forth, from the topographical point of view, therefore, it is a phenomenon which takes place in the outermost cortex of the ego. It is true, however, that we also receive conscious information from the inside of the body. Inside the body, feelings which actually exercise a more peremptory, more strongly imperative influence on our mental life than external perceptions. So what Freud seems to be arguing is that sometimes your internal states, particularly memories and things like that, or memories that happen to be evoked by sort of semi-random stimuli, can contribute more to what you perceive in your conscious sort of experiential world than external sense data. So he says, I'll repeat that bit, it is true, however, that we also receive conscious information from inside of the body, feelings which actually exercise a more peremptory influence on our mental life than external perceptions. This is the work of the function of speech, he says specifically, which brings material into the ego in a firm connection with mnemic residues, meaning memories, of visual, but more particularly of auditory perceptions. Now, I think the ramifications of this quotation are quite interesting. You know, Freud in popular culture is much more strongly associated with ideas to do with emotions, sort of repressed memories, and much less associated with an interest in actual mechanisms of perception. People who are well informed about Freud will, no doubt disagree with that, but certainly I think that's the case in popular culture. So, the process by which, quote, internal processes in the ego may also acquire the quality of consciousness, that's a direct quote from Freud there, internal processes in the ego may also acquire the quality of consciousness, i.e. as being perceived reality, being perceived as being real events in the external world, is demonstrated in the auditory realm by listening to Diana Deutsch's recording, and in the visual realm by watching demonstrations such as the Analysis of Beauty video. And to conclude the talk completely, such demonstrations strongly support Freud's contention that, quote, the equation perception equals reality no longer holds. Thank you. Far away. Especially if you know more about anything that I've talked about than I do. Particularly Freud and things like that. Any questions? Yeah.
So, behind it is not the idea of the schemas that Candy
World
from so long ago. The idea that we all have schemas.
Yeah.
That we perceive the world according to the schemas that we already have.
Yeah.
So that's...
I'm not familiar with that idea, but I think what, I would imagine that, what we're talking about here are the kind of sort of small fragments of memory, perhaps, that could contribute to the sort of schema that might determine somebody's personality in a more sort of, not exactly global sense because it's just one person, but, in a much expanded sense,
the
little...
construction that we make of the world is what we actually end up...
Yeah, and a classic example of how that process would be revealed is with mishearings and Freudian slips and things like that, where people's linguistic behaviour expresses something that's very personal and unique to them. But actually, similar processes are also responsible for constructing everything else that we say and hear as well. You know, as well as the things that we get wrong, they're also responsible for the things that we get right. You know?
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit more about the schema?
Yeah. Analysis. They're used in different ways, you know, and how we perceive the world is according to what is already we set in our mind, you know, whatever we have learned. So it's there's a lot of learned experience, and then we try to. That's why, like, cognitive psychology itself is not only related to itself, but it's just really related to a lot of other.
Yeah. I think one of the things I tried to communicate, which I hope comes across in the talk, is that, you know, because, you know, you try to, you know, you sort of present a demonstration or a presentation which sort of tries to convince people that actually a lot of what we experience has a partly imaginative, reconstructive aspect to it. So it's sort of counterintuitive to think that the perceptions that we receive aren't, you know, have this imaginary aspect, because, you know, if you knock on the table or bang the wall or sort of walk around, you know, the chances are you're going to get around the Freud Museum, leave the Freud Museum this evening without missing a step and falling down the stairs and all that kind of stuff, you know, that you have these very highly developed perceptual strategies that enable you to perceive the world accurately, you know, and the fact that, you know, some of that is based on projection or an imaginative faculty doesn't, you know, it intuitively disagrees with the perception that the understanding that those perceptions are actually reliable indications of how the world actually behaves. So, you know, it takes kind of illusions to be the kind of entry point for people to dive in and kind of pull things apart and realise that, in fact, the mechanisms, you know, I suppose the point I'm trying to emphasise is that the mechanisms that produce illusions are the same mechanisms that produce reality, what we perceive as being.
I like the way that you use putting together of sound and video as an example. I used to study music technology. We did a unit on acoustics. And it went into a little bit of this sort of stuff. But it was more the unit that was about sound from the moving image, like redubbing cartoons.
Yeah.
Like, you have so much creative space available to you. You can do pretty much whatever you want.
Yeah.
So long as you can make the listener, the watcher, believe that is the sound that thing that they see is making. You know, like you see someone switch on a cartoon, and you could make it make any noise.
Yeah.
Like, it could be like a kettle making the sound of a Hoover.
Yeah.
You'll just accept it.
Funnily enough, we were looking at a book about Sonic Branding last night, and there's a bit in there about cartoons where it's, you know, the whole kind of slapstick thing which originated in the theatre is that you actually put inappropriate sound effects for visual events, as long as they're synchronised in time, you know, the fact that somebody makes a cartoon boing when they fall over or something like that, rather than the actual naturalistic sound that would occur in that situation, doesn't matter. McGurk Effect video was originally created by accident. I believe the story was that they asked a technician at the university to make this recording for them for purposes unknown, and it came back all wrong, and they discovered the illusion, you know, as an accidental mistake in that process. Please.
Please correct me if I'm wrong at all. Perceptual processes are really, it's an argument whether it's a top-down or a bottom-up process.
Yeah.
That's quite a basic level understanding of it. There's a contemporary kind of theory in neuroscience and neurolinguistics that these sorts of audio processing doesn't necessarily occur in the auditory cortex.
Yeah.
So what you hear, like you said, it's your processes, your perceptual processes are putting information down onto the sounds. It's very complicated. And I wanted to know what you kind of thought, because you've explained a lot about perceptual processes with projection.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know if you had an opinion on how, especially with EVP, because I imagine this would really work with this, how predictive processes in perception might kind of overarch with all of this, and whether you had any thoughts.
Well, I believe that the it's difficult to really prove this, so I'm bluffing it slightly, but the not McGurk, which, sorry, I've got, and the Albert Bregman recording where you got the kind of thing, that's partly a predictive illusion, as well as being a sort of retrospective. You know, you're not just trying to sort of recover stuff that you just heard and you're having trouble making sense of, but it's a predictive illusion as well. And I mean, there are lots of when somebody finishes somebody else's sentence for them, I mean, that's the process which enables you to be able to accurately predict what somebody else was going to say when they pause is the same process that although it's not actually exactly the same mechanism that's involved, your mind creates an image of what the complete sentence would be, and you can take over from somebody if they're speaking, say, right? Equally, that underlying mechanism is the one that also contributes to the accuracy of your hearing as well, because if you have the words Venezuela is not likely to follow the word fish fingers sideways or something like that. There are kind of mathematically determined probabilities about which kind of sequences of sounds on a microscopic level and words on a larger level are likely to follow each other. And those, contribute to not only to your ability to pick up from what somebody else has said, but also to your ability to hear things. And the meaning that you're actually hearing. But, a lot of the stuff that I've read is frankly quite kind of out-of-date textbooks. And a lot of the real cutting-edge work that's being done in this field is to do with brain imaging and things like that. And I don't know very much about neuroanatomy. If you perhaps done some work in that area yourself, I don't know if you've got anything you can add,
You talked about studying 1996 and kind of in research that
was
kind of like 20 years ago. That's old.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Gave us basically the same talk, and there's a guy called Pradeep Shane Mungalima from the speech science lab, I forget exactly what it's called, at UCL. And he says, oh yeah, sine wave speech has been around forever because he's about 25. It's like, and it's like, a lot of the stuff I'm reading is actually, kind of gestalt psychology stuff from the 30s, which gestalt psychology is largely considered to have been superseded, but actually quite a lot of the anecdotal detail in things like, a book about what the BBC did during the Second World War is extremely revealing in terms of, some of this kind of subject matter.
You want an up-to-date textbook on that area, which I did some Nelk and Schnook and King, Auditory Neuroscience.
Yeah.
It's a very good intro guide for that.
Yeah. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Please, yeah.
So when you're reading these books that you say are out of date, do you think you're reading them as science or are you reading them as fiction? Is there some sort of reading against the grain? Is there just a cultural analysis?
Yeah.
And the sort of religious beliefs that you describe?
Yeah.
You think they're hearing ghosts?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can think of plenty of examples, sort of anecdotal ones, of people finding voices of the dead in technology, and it's not that.
Yeah.
Something like, Joan Didion's book, The Year of Magical Thinking, is about mourning.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this does...
Her husband's mobile phone was the last place that she believed within sort of inhabited.
Yeah.
And that seems to me a belief that is kind of cultural. You could look at it anthropologically.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of thinking about this, because you're an artist, about the sort of science in this.
Well, yeah, I mean,
your texts and what you're reading
A lot of this kind of stuff does overlap quite substantially with things to do with bereavement psychology and things like that. It's one of the line, there are lots of different versions of this talk, and I kind of tweak them a bit depending on the audience. And Richard Gregory in the Oxford Companions of the Mind says in the section on bereavement, I think, and quote it directly, sights and sounds of the deceased are often misinterpreted as signifying the return of the deceased. And I mean, on a, I hesitate to say artistic level, but as a sort of subjective or, potentially artistic, not the right word, experience, those kind of perceptions when we have them, and I've had them, can be incredibly moving, So, I try to tread a bit gently on EVP because, I don't think it's a dishonest belief system in some ways, but it appeals to emotions that everybody can share, you know, which is, and everybody can identify with. You know, if you wanted to create, almost as a kind of experiment, the strongest motive you could possibly invent for trying to get somebody to be interested in a factually nonsensical belief system, suggesting that you might be able to be reunited with your deceased friends and relatives, is probably the strongest one you could ever invent to give people an actual motive. You know, the cultural analysis is very interesting. I don't think it's really anything new, though. I think it's just a fundamental of, you know, human bereavement psychology that goes back. You know, there's stuff in the Bible about people who claim to be able to communicate with the dead. You know, it's a universal human experience that will probably never go away.
Yeah, if you think about schizophrenia and hearing voices and things like that, how much does it play the mind, really?
I think there's sort of reasonable anecdotal evidence to suggest that Jurgensen had quite serious schizotypal.
See?
Friedrich Jurgensen, the guy who sort of invented EVP, had some pretty serious psychological issues along those kind of lines. But you know, another point I try to emphasise is that this is, although similar processes may be involved, this is really about normal perception. It's, you know, these kind of faculties may reoccur in schizophrenic experiences, for instance, possibly. But equally, like a lot of thinking about auditory hallucinations now, is again, similar faculties will be involved in the formation of auditory hallucinations. Actually, a lot of people who have auditory hallucinations are not experiencing any psychiatric symptoms at all. You know, it was previously thought as being a sort of fairly, you know, cast iron diagnostic criteria. If you heard voices, you were schizophrenic. And that's not believed to be the case anymore. There are lots of people who hear voices and music and things like that who have no other psychiatric symptoms.
Someone who
works
with people who are psychotic.
Yeah.
What I noticed is that when I was working in my community in the evening and in the building where I worked, if I put the radio on, people who were hearing voices felt it. They were a lot more comfortable with being with me, and the fact that it would go from, there was almost complete silence.
Yeah.
No, people would be in their rooms and things like that.
Yeah.
But if I put, usually it would gather them on.
Yeah.
There would literally maybe be four or five people maybe just sat with their back to the wall.
Yeah.
And it enabled a kind of a being with without intruding upon.
Yeah.
Distracting from the awful traumatic voices that they were hearing.
Yeah.
And created some form of togetherness to the point at which some of my patients insisted that they bought their tapes to listen to during their sessions. And
yeah.
I could bring a tape to play them, to listen to them. But I think with schizophrenia, it is about the confusion of kind of what's real and what's not.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not terribly well informed about this kind of stuff. Did a little bit of clinical psychology a long time ago on a very superficial level. What was I going to say? My thinking is that the problem's possibly, you know, contradict me if I'm wrong by all means, but it's not so much about whether or not people might hear voices, but how people sort of rationalise what they're hearing and whether or not they're able to deal with the, you know, the So it's very interesting you said that. Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. I mean, remember somebody said, might sound a bit trivial, but somebody said to me once, you know, if you've got a bunch of kittens and they've been separated from their mother and they're crying, you would wrap an alarm clock in a sock and put it in the basket with the babies, and the kittens would think it was a heartbeat, their mother's heartbeat, and they'd all go to sleep. You know? So.
I was just thinking of the bicamera on mine. That's a sort of 70s look, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's very interesting, you know,
Well, I haven't read it, but it's this theory that people who heard voices maybe this is the origin of some religious, you know, fundamental origin.
Not really, but also had a very particular function. If you're divorced from your community, you were out like a shepherd.
Yeah.
You kind of almost have your own radio show, hear your loved ones, hear your people, keep sane, rather than go insane via the voices. It would be sort of keep your auditory kind of familiarity going, and that these kind of experiences that can be sort of more or less, I think, coincidental, or kind of, in a sense, what's the word? Not just coincidental, but sort of sought after and sort of embraced. Are quite interesting. I think people often try and hear the voices of people who've died just because they want to hear the voice. Listen again.
I think
that's quite interesting, because that's almost the opposite of schizophrenic voices, auditory hallucinations. It's a sort of willed auditory channeling. I think it's quite a different from the, what are the people called? The PDF? No.
PTSD.
Yeah.
PTSD.
Yes,
the voices in this organisation.
What do you mean?
ESPP?
Yeah. People's dispensaries. PTSD.
Yeah. Well, heartbeat made to premature children.
Yeah.
That could be quite heavily linked to the fact that most commercial dance music is made at 120 beats per minute.
Absolutely. I mean, electronic music is based on, I wrote a sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek article once, synchronified electronic heartbeats. I don't want to get all too sort of cosmic about kind of acid house, but that's definitely true. I just don't like to admit it.
This is 90 years ago when I was studying music.
Yeah, absolutely. Trance and drone music and things like that are tapping into real kind of fundamentals of sort of human perception.
I was just wondering, because you mentioning about perception and reality and obviously external stimuli, and I guess my question is a bit neurologic, in where does that actually happen, if you know where does that happen, if it's, for example, the occipital lobe and auditory, just receive the information, is the part processing it that affects that illusion of sound of that voice, what you're saying?
Yeah, I don't really know anything about neuroanatomy, unfortunately. But I'm well aware that that's where a lot of the interesting stuff's taking place nowadays. And one of the things I really like to do is, like, the problem with MRI machines, brain scanners, is getting stuff in there, because there's a really powerful magnetic field and a really confined space. So could you put some little mirrors over somebody's eyes so they could watch the analysis of beauty exhibit and see which bits were being triggered in the brain when it flips direction, for instance, undoubtedly that's where a lot of the interesting stuff's taking place, in terms of research.
I think we've got time for maybe one more question.
I've got a very theoretical question that kind of takes it away from the auditory area. You mentioned that to treat EVP kind of lightly because it's a belief system. But arguably the scientific side of things is also a belief system that is based on your perceptions of the evidence. And whether you had an opinion on that as yourself through your work.
I mean, it's sometimes said, for instance, I'm not certain this is what you're saying, but I think it may well overlap with it, that, science is a kind of social construct and things like that. And it's like, well, yeah, even if it is, so what? It happens to be a social construct that, makes repeatable predictions, reliable predictions about reality, which can be repeated much more reliably than other social constructs, So, there are very valid cases to be made for, that interpretation of science, but equally that doesn't, it's a classic example of this kind of thing.
The Mechikiwa illusion, that both sides can be right. You can have two interpretations of the same evidence that are simultaneously correct. Another point to make is that a lot of the people who sort of defend stuff with EVP in the arts and things like that have a critique of science, a sort of postmodern critique of science, which is based on analysing scientific culture and science as a profession
and as an anthropological entity, but really what I'm talking about is science as a method. You know, so methodology and scientific method and scientific culture are not necessarily the same thing. They do overlap quite a lot. You know, it's quite possible for people to be distinguished scientists, professional scientists involved, immersed in the whole culture of science, who don't necessarily apply scientific method very well. Just because they're scientists doesn't mean to say that they necessarily apply method in, you know, very rigorous ways. You know, so.
I'm aware there are probably more questions at this point. I'm afraid we have to stop, so it just remains to please give a big thank you to Joe.